Well, good morning, everyone. Happy feast to you all. Uh-oh, I think I need some help. I forgot my notes, my jacket. This is the wrong jacket. It's good. We're good. Ah, okay. Great, thank you. That's refreshing. Okay, everything's settled now. That is my millennial illustration right there. Any of your kids do that for you? No, you got one, eh? You can come live with me. It's great to be back here again. We've been waiting all year to finally come back to the Feast of Tabernacles. It's been over a year, in fact, and we're here celebrating for a third time this location, sixth time overall. My lovely wife is here with us, the prettiest girl in the room since 1997. I got my two boys are here with us this feast as well, and that was Caleb who helped me out here this morning. And then, of course, we have the second prettiest girl in the room. That's Faith in the pink wheelchair back there. If you haven't met her yet, hope you get a chance to meet her. Once you get to know her a little bit, she's just a little bit sassy. Jill knows about that. Yep, you are doing it right now. So it's great to be back here once again, and I hope you all are having a wonderful time this feast so far in the early part of the going here. Hope you've enjoyed it. I've got a slideshow for you today, and I'd like you to, actually you don't need to turn to anything if you don't want to, unless you want to double check on me, but we've got slides and we've got the, if it's going to work. Oh, here we go. Thank you. All right, so our first scripture here to start us off is Deuteronomy 32, chapter 10. He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of a wilderness he encircled him, he cared for him, he guarded him with the apple of his eye. These are the words of Moses the prophet about how God found Israel in a barren wasteland, how he found him in a desert. And it's really part of a much bigger picture in the Bible. You see, the Bible begins the story of this watery chaos that was churning over the earth. And it was Jeremiah who made the connection of the chaos of water with the desert. So the desert then has become a metaphor for chaos, for pain, and for suffering. And it's an interesting metaphor because on the one hand, the desert is dangerous and it's filled with peril. You have dangerous snakes, you've got scorpions, you have bears and lions. You even have demons in the desert. You have hot sun beating down on you. You don't have shade in the desert. Yet sometimes it's also a place of refuge. If you remember, David found refuge in the desert when he was hiding from Saul. Also, of course, we know the Israelites went to the desert to get away from Pharaoh. Moses found refuge in the desert as he was fleeing from Pharaoh as well. And we learned about Elijah just the other day, how he fled to the desert to get away from Queen Jezebel. The desert then is envisioned as a place of peril and a place of danger, but it's also a place of refuge and a place of provision. When we think about desert, normally we think about something like this. This is a picture of the Sahara Desert. You can see for miles and miles on the Sahara Desert. It's just sand dunes all around. And that's usually what we conjure up in our mind when we think about desert. But the deserts of the mountains of, or the wilderness of Sinai is actually something more like this. This is the deserts that we're talking about. They're very mountainous. They have wadis that run through dry riverbeds. They have canyons. All throughout the Sinai Peninsula, it looks similar to this. You can't really see maybe 200 yards in front of you or 200 yards behind you because you're going through these canyon areas. I want you to consider for a moment, here's another picture of the wilderness, that the patriarchs were desert people. We go back and we think about Abraham and Sarah. They were desert people. You think about Isaac and Rebekah, dwelled in the desert as well. Then Jacob and his two wives, Leah and Rachel, they were desert dwellers as well, right there on the edge of the Fertile Crescent in the Negev. And these men and women that gave birth to the nation of Israel were desert people. So was Moses. We just talked about him. He spent 80 years in the desert. Israel as a nation, in a sense, was born and brought to maturity in the desert. And of course, we know that David was a desert shepherd. So what I'm trying to say is that Israel understood desert really well. I don't think we understand desert today very well. So if they lived it, you would expect that many of the word pictures and metaphors about life are going to be desert pictures. Middle Easterners, you find, want a picture. They want to know that God is a rock. They think about him that way. God is eagle wings, right? They think about word pictures. So it shouldn't surprise us that a high percentage of the biblical images that teach us about who we are, about who God is, about what life is about, comes out of the desert. So I'd like to spend some time today in my sermon, and I want you to journey with me through the desert. Because, brethren, in some ways, this is where we're at today. I think we can compare our time in this flesh to desert. This is where we dwell. We're sort of in between the coming out of Egypt, which we all came out of, and we're traveling right to the promised land. We all understand that. But right now, we're in that in-between area. We're in the desert. You know, even if you didn't want to compare this existence to a desert wandering or a desert traveling, we do have desert moments in life. I think everybody has had those desert moments. And these are times which are tough, and these are times when we get to meet God face to face. So as we begin today, I want you to think like an ancient Israelite. I want you to forget all of the images that you have in your head from a Western cultural perspective, because most of them are wrong. You haven't studied Israel and the land over there. You're not really going to understand a lot of these things, concepts that the Old Testament is talking about and trying to bring out. There are many lessons in the desert, and I want to show you some today through something that you might not expect to see, and that is through trees. Now, I want you to put yourself in the desert. And the first thing that we think about in the desert is usually the hot sun. When you're in a desert, it is intensely hot. In the daytime, the heat can get so intense, it's overbearing. This past summer, I took my son, Max, to Israel on a trip, and we spent about 2 weeks over there, and we spent some time in the Negev. And it was unseasonably hot that particular time when we were there. It was about 116 degrees in the Negev, and we were out in the wilderness of Timnah. And at some point, maybe within 10 or 15 minutes, you're looking around for shade, and you're trying to find something to give you a respite from the hot sun. And as far as we looked, we couldn't find anything. There wasn't hardly anything around. There were a few things. There were some opportunities for shade if you weren't in the tent itself where they had some air conditioning. You might find a tree, or you might find something that would grow out of a craggy rock, a bush that would provide some relief from the hot sun. This right here, this bush is called a rhodum. This is the first tree we're going to look at. It's called a rhodum. In English, we call this a broom tree. It's called a broom tree. It has these yellow leaves and white blossoms on it, and it serves for food for goats or camels, for man or beast alike. It provides shade so that you can have a little bit of a respite under the sun. Now, I don't know if you can tell from this particular picture of this video here, but because of the way that the leaves are shaped, it doesn't give you a total blackout. There's not a total sun blackout. It casts sort of a partial shade on the ground you can see right there. So it's not completely blocked out. And so as you sit down under the tree, you'll have a little respite from the sun. But some of the sun makes it through those leaves. But it does make it quite cooler for sure. This is God's provision in the desert. You see it in a couple of stories in the Bible. You see it, for instance, from the story of Hagar and Ishmael when they were sent away. And Hagar brought Ishmael down under a broom tree, under a rotem. And she set him under there, and she went under another one and thought she was going to die. And, of course, we know that they were saved from the angel of the Lord who came and saved them. But that particular tree that she sat under was a broom tree. The Bible doesn't actually call it a broom tree, if you're going to look that up. But afterwards, the name of the place is called Rithma, which actually comes from Rotem. So scholars are pretty sure this is a Rotem tree. We also see the broom tree come into view in 1 Kings chapter 19. It was the source of refuge for Elijah as he fled to the wilderness from Jezebel. We also see it in Job chapter 30. The roots were sustenance for those who needed food when they didn't have food in those days. Now imagine, if you could, I want you to think about when heat is overwhelming you. And I want you to think about some situation in your life when the heat is so hot that it drives on you or pounds on you, and when you say, it is so hot, I don't know what I'm going to do. How am I going to deal with this? I know that all of you in here, at one time or another, has had a desert moment in your life. In most cases, they can come in different forms. Maybe the most popular, if I can say that, form is maybe financial problems or health problems, right? Or relationship problems. Those seem to be the biggest three issues. I have some desert moments I'd like to share with you, if I could. We were leaving for the feast here recently, and I had to move the car seat from one car to the other for Faith so she could sit in it. And you parents will understand this. You got those little locks there on the bottom, right? And you got these things you're trying to put in. And I'm trying to put this thing in. And it won't go in. Okay, take a moment. I come back. I need my wife to help me because I can't get it in. That's not a desert moment. That's just an inconvenience. We all have inconveniences. I heard a lot of people get up at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning to be able to get to the feast here. That's an inconvenience. Wouldn't call it a desert moment if it's not the best thing that we like to do when we go to the feast to get up so early. Sometimes we're excited about it, I think, but we'd rather not do that. I remember when I was about 14, and back in the days of the Worldwide Church of God, we were going to a Wow You dance. And I woke up one morning, and I had the biggest pimple on my forehead. It was kind of like the horn of Daniel 7. And you know, the more you mess with it, the redder it gets because it gets more angry. And so I resorted to putting some Clarisil on it, the makeup for men. And I went to the dance and I sort of hid in the corner because I was sort of a cross, I felt, in some play of, you know, the Beast of Revelation and Beauty and the Beast. I didn't want to be seen. At 14, really, that's a desert moment. If you haven't had a big pimple on your face and you're going to see some girls, that's kind of tough. I got over that. Those aren't tough desert moments. Those, you look back on them, you say, well, that wasn't too bad. At the time, it was kind of significant, but at the back, you know, you look later. I have had rougher desert moments since then, and I know you have too. Let me tell you about a serious one that I had. This was just maybe about 7 years ago. Many of you know that we have a daughter who has spina bifida. And spina bifida is a condition where the nerves don't make it to the legs because the back is open. When she's born, she had an open back. She's being sassy. And so the nerves don't make it all the way down. Of course, this was a major trial for us when we found out about this. She was born. She was in the hospital in St. Louis for, I think all told, maybe 66 days or so. And we didn't actually get a hold of her until I think she was 2 weeks old. The whole time, just a really rough desert moment for us. So I would go there every Tuesday and Thursday with our boys, who were 2 and 5 at the time, and my wife would stay at a Ronald McDonald House, and I would drive over there every Thursday and Sunday. I was off of work, so we'd drive over there, and we would spend the night with them, and then come back on the weekends so I could get back to work again. One day we came back, it was close to the 4th of July weekend area, and I went up to work. My sister-in-law, who thankfully was there to help us watch the boys, came up to the office. We were very close to where we lived. And she said one of our sons was in his bed unresponsive. So I ran down to the house. And I see him laying in the bed with his eyes turned one way and his arm pulled up. And I scoop him up. I put him in my truck and I go to the emergency room. And it turned out he was having what's called a status epilepticus seizure. This kind of seizure is a type of seizure that if you don't stop it, will usually result in death or brain damage. So thankfully they were able to stop it. They transported him to a children's hospital about 30 minutes away in Columbia. I called my wife. She had to come over. So at this moment, we have two children, one in a PICU, NICU, neonatal intensive care unit in St. Louis, and then we have one 2 hours later over here in Columbia in a pediatric intensive care unit. Two kids, 2 hours apart, two different intensive care units. One of the worst desert moments of my life. I know you've had them as well. I know you've all had them. I'd like you to look at a scripture. We can bring it up. Psalm 121 and verse 5. The Lord is the shade at my right hand. The Lord is the shade at my right hand. Brethren, if this is the shade tree, look at the shade that God promises you and me. Just enough to give us a little bit of rest. It's not a blockout shade, right? How I wish I could tell you that when life's trials come upon you, that God is going to spring up a mighty oak tree and just completely block out all of that sun and drop the temperature to 70 degrees and take all the heat away that's sapping your energy. And while God does have the power to do that, and sometimes He does, God looks and says, I'm going to give you just enough shade for a few moments, and then you can go one more day, about one more bend on life's walk. When you say, the Lord is my shade, I want you to stop conjuring up an image of a giant oak tree or a big maple tree. You see, the image of the Middle Eastern mind is not that everything is absolutely beautiful, but rather in my pain, God has enjoined me with a little bit of Himself, just enough so that in the form of a broom tree, I can continue to keep going. Now, I'm sure you all have desert moments in your life and you can share them here as the feast goes on. And maybe where you're at, you haven't found shade yet. But maybe God is saying to you that if you'll wait just a little bit longer and you go around that bend just a little bit further, you're going to have a broom tree waiting just for you in the form of somebody who's there to help you. So when God says that I am the shade at your right hand, I want you to all take your right hand if you have it available, and I want you to raise your right hand, and I want you to say, the Lord is the shade at my right hand. Stretch it out. Reach out as far as you can go. That's as far away as God's ever going to be from you. It's as far as away. The shade is always that close. But as much as God says that He is the shade at your right hand and promises shade in the desert, He partners in the process. In fact, God does all of His stuff through partners. He has others that help him and serve him in that way. In Psalm chapter 80, verses 8 through 10 here, it says, "You removed a vine from Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground before it, and it took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shade, and the cedars of God with its boughs." So God wanted Israel to be a shade for the nations of the earth. And at many times they were. But there was a time when they weren't. They weren't shading people in the earth. And the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh were really called to be shades for this whole earth. And in many ways, they have been for this whole earth. But individually, he calls you and me to be shade for others as well. But that shade's limited. God is never further, right, than your right hand. But that shade that he uses is limited to your right hand in that sense. So it's kind of where you meet God, if I can say that way, to help cover somebody. So if God is right there and you can stretch out your arm and you can provide shade, then between God and you, everyone's covered. If everybody put out their right hand and you covered somebody in this room, everybody in this room would be covered. Right? Except for those on the very end. Sorry, Joel. So everybody's within reach to cover somebody else. Isaiah chapter 32. Verses 1 and 2. This is a prophecy of the kingdom, but it also has a present day applications to us as well. "Behold, a king will reign righteously, and princes will rule justly, and man will be like a refuge from the wind and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land." This is speaking of Jesus Christ. You can read our Bible reading program on this. Some people think it's Hezekiah. This is speaking about Jesus Christ and about you, about what's to come in the future. But this applies to you today. You don't get off scot-free today. You have to apply this today. You see, today you are not only promised his shade, you are called to be his shade to those who are hurting, so that your fellow brother can go around one more bend and one more corner so that they can reach one more broom tree. So I'd like you all to learn as you walk through those painful experiences in your life that you experience shade from someone else, and you take that experience and you provide it for someone else that is experiencing the same thing that you had. And you will give them a little bit of respite from that desert sun during their hard times. This next tree is called a tamarisk tree. This particular tree is an interesting tree because it typically doesn't grow on its own. And it needs some sort of cultivation, some care, at least initially. So you come across this tree usually where people live, and it requires some care and protection. You have to keep the camels away from it, the goats, they'll tear it up. So it typically doesn't grow in rugged conditions. You actually see some of these trees around the Dead Sea because they like salty conditions. But this tamarisk tree has small-scale leaves and small branches which give it this sort of a pine-like appearance that you can kind of see there. And during the heat of the day, the tamarisk secretes salt, and the salt then dries. And then overnight, the salt absorbs the moisture, what little there is from the desert. And in the morning, it evaporates, and it creates this cooling effect. So they say the tamarisk tree is one of the best trees to give you shade and to cool you if you're out there in the desert. This tree is considered a really slow-growing tree, and some have said that it takes up to 400 years to grow to its full height. In the desert conditions, it just takes a while to get that big, which means that you don't plant this tree for yourself. You don't even plant this tree for your children. Maybe your grandchildren, but probably not even them. Maybe your great-grandchildren will be able to use this tree, and they'll begin to enjoy it. This tree comes into view in Genesis chapter 21. It says, Abram Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba. Real simple statement. And you wonder, why did he plant a tamarisk tree in Beersheba? This is the southern part of Israel. This is where the desert begins. There's really nothing out there but rocks and sand. And when you look at the previous chapters, you think, well, maybe he did it because of the treaty that he had between Abimelech and himself about the wells that were dug there. And they're like, well, who dug these wells? And he was going to do this as a monument to that. But I don't think that's actually what's going on here. God says to Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. He called him out of Ur. I'm going to give you this land. And in chapter 21, Abraham goes and he plants a tamarisk tree at Beersheba. Now, I want you to think about the meaning of that act. Abraham didn't own one square inch of that land. He didn't even have a place to bury his wife or himself. He had to buy something, a plot, from the Hittite, Ephron the Hittite, I believe. But it's as if he was saying when he planted it, I believe you, God. I believe that one day you will give this land to my ancestor or to my descendants, and that they will live here and they will obtain the promised land. Brethren, how long was the sojourn? Roughly 400 years. How long does it take the tamarisk tree to grow to full height? Roughly 400 years. I love the imagery here, because if you understand the tamarisk tree, the principle that it teaches is this. How much of your life is about you? How much of your life is about you? Doing what brings me comfort or enjoyment or will gain something for me, and how much do I do that will bless people for generations yet to come? Not just your kids, but for those who come after them. Proverbs 13 says, a good person leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Now that's long-term thinking. That's long-term planning. What do I do today that will benefit others tomorrow, next year, next decade? You know, if you've had children or you have children, you understand that you put a lot of cultivation into them, and they don't grow well on their own. They need lots of care. They need lots of protection. And you don't do it with an expectation of a reward. Like, there was one book that said, kids are time capsules that you send into the future that you're never going to see. That's a kind of a neat thing. Whatever you put into them, they're going to take on to the next generation. Now, I could ask it this way. Did you plant a tamarisk tree today? Will you plant a tamarisk tree tomorrow? Will you do anything today that will outlive you and bless others decades or centuries down the road? And this doesn't have to apply physically. This is a spiritual application. What impact has your example? What impact has your speech? What impact has your teaching, your discussions had on others? As we all search for the same thing that Abraham searched for, the city that's built without hands. What we do today and say today and act today can have long-lasting implications for others in their lives for years to come. I can think back on things that I heard at the Feast of Tabernacles when I was a young teenager, and they have had an impact on my life for the next 30 and 40 years. And that's all passed on to the next generation. Abraham didn't just wait for someone else to build the tamarisk tree. He didn't just hunker down in a cave and endure to the end. He did something in faith that would impact generations to come. So while we're here waiting for the return of Christ, what are we doing to benefit others to that end? We start first with our families, the close-knit unit, and we expand outward to those in our church community, and then even into our communities. How and what are you doing to make an impact on those that we come in contact with? This is an acacia tree. It's known as a Bedouin's best friend. They call it this because there are so many uses from this particular acacia tree. One of the obvious is shade. It casts this great shadow that makes the desert somewhat bearable. But if a branch or a limb falls off of this tree, the Bedouins can take it and they can make a fire from it, make some, keep some warm. And since it grows really slowly, you can get a really hot fire from it. If the bark is injured, get that. If the bark is injured on this particular tree, it bleeds this black tarry substance. And the Bedouins use it, use the black sap, and they boil it, and they use it for stomach troubles, for skin conditions, a salve. And it also has medicinal qualities. It has these tiny leaves that the camels will eat as well. And when it's in season, it produces this pod right here. And the Bedouins say that if they can collect about 1 kilo of these pods, they can boil it and they can feed a camel for about a week. So this is a tree with a lot of uses. This is a slow-growing tree again. This is a picture of Max when we were in Israel at Timnah. And this is a really small acacia tree that was by the tent in the wilderness there that we saw. And you can see the shade as well. So there's a big acacia tree, a full-grown one. In the Negev, we saw a scattering of these acacia trees. In the Sinai, in the desert, is also spotted with acacia trees. But when you find these trees, especially in the Sinai, you'll find them at the edge of wadis. And wadis are dry riverbeds. These riverbeds collect water during the rainy season. The rocks don't really absorb, right, the rain that well. So as they run down, they collect, and they collect very rapidly. And they'll have these flash floods that will occur in these wadis. You don't want to be around there during the rainy season. You will get washed away. They come so quickly. It's amazing. We were there in Qumran, and they said that a couple of climbers actually got washed away because the floods came so quickly. It rained like miles away. The sky was clear where they were. But as the waters collect, it runs down there, and you have these flash floods that occur. And so they have these horns in Israel to warn you when a flood's going to come. But acacia trees don't really grow on the side of the hills or in the middle of the wadi, but they grow just close enough to the edge so that the roots will grow out. And they'll get into that water from the floods. When there isn't water and there's a drought that happens every so often, the trees will go dormant and they'll wait patiently until the next flood comes along, and it'll blossom and it'll bloom and bear fruit once again. Dr. Noga Haravani, if I'm saying that right, Haravini, is one of the leading scholars on biblical plants. He believes that this is the tree of Jeremiah 17. I want you to just look at Jeremiah 17 with me here. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord. He is like a tree planted by waters that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes, for its leaves remain green and is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. Now, you may not recognize that from Jeremiah 17. It's not typically a scripture that we're going to memorize. However, you may recognize this from another scripture in Psalm chapter 1. It's the same tree. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law, which says Torah, of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and all he does, he prospers. Now let's stop for a moment. I would guess that this tree right here is not the tree that you have in your head when you read Psalm chapter 1. Or Jeremiah 17. When I read Psalm chapter 1 for years, I pictured this bubbling creek with this big oak tree in like 40 acres of lovely alfalfa. That's kind of what I pictured. Listen, that's not it. That's not the same thing. It's a beautiful picture, but it's probably wrong. Now, I'm not going to try and convince you here that this is the tree of Jeremiah 17 or Psalm 1. But I want you to see that if you were in the culture of the Israelites and you read Psalm 1 or Jeremiah 17, this is the picture you would have. There are no other trees that are planted by these streams of water. The acacia tree is it, and guess what? It bears fruit in its season. In other words, from a desert point of view, this is a picture of someone who has roots that are deeply embedded in the water that's produced from these floods and produces fruit in its season, and it provides all kinds of things over generations and generations to those that come along that need help. For communities, it has salve for medicine. It has leaves and flowers for food. It has wood for warmth. This is the wood that was used to build the Ark of the Covenant, to use to build the altar of incense, the table of showbread. They used this tree right here. So God had to make sure that those were there when the children of Israel came about, so they had something to build those things. It seems then that in the desert, in this life, we are called to be broom trees. We are called to be acacia trees. We are called to be tamarisk trees because they all have shade and they all provide a lot more for generations. Are you like one of these trees? As people walk through your path of life, can they stop under your shade for a few moments to get a respite from the heat that they're going through so that they can continue on? How do you become like trees planted by streams of water? How is that possible? Well, look back at Psalm chapter 1 again. He meditates on it day and night. And when he does that, he's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. So how do you become like a tree? You meditate on it day and night. Now, there's a Hebrew word that I need you to know here that I think that would be helpful in this particular situation. And the sound of the word illustrates its meaning. The Hebrew word is Hagah. It's Hagah. And what that means is it's the sound that a lion makes when he tears into its kill. When he's really hungry and he's tearing at its kill, he makes that sound if he hasn't eaten in a while. So if you want to illustrate, you know, its meaning, you actually don't say Hagah, you say Hagah, Hagah, right? That's what it means. It sounds just like it. That's what a lion does when he eats. Isaiah chapter 31, you can reference this. As a lion growls, which is Hagah, a great lion over its prey, and though a whole band of shepherds is called together against it, it's not frightened by their shouts. So that Hebrew word in the passage is the word Hagah. In Jeremiah 17 and Psalm chapter 1, it says, "Blessed is the one who doesn't walk in the path of the wicked, but his delight is on God's law, and on his law he Hagahs over it day and night." Now, oftentimes we think of the idea of quiet meditation in a room, quiet and peaceful, maybe even by a bubbling stream. And that's what we think of when we think about this. And there's a time and place for that, but that's not what this is talking about. There's the implication that the one who is planted like by streams of waters, the acacia person among you is somebody who Hagahs, right? Who treats this book as if to say, I'm hungry and I'm going to get every fiber and every sinew out of what it says to me. And it has to become a part of your very being. And when it does, slowly but surely, God turns you into an acacia tree. But notice, the acacia tree is a very slow-growing tree, so it takes some time, and it takes some serious hagahing to be able to grow in that type of tree. You can't skip the hard work of what God calls you to be. This next tree is called the Sodom apple tree. The Sodom apple tree. Again, Dr. Haravini has argued that this is the Arar tree, A-R-A-R. And this tree grows in the middle of nowhere, really. It's said that the roots go down more than a couple hundred feet to reach water. And because of that, it can survive in extreme desert conditions. And when it's green, it has this stunning, you can see stunning, forest green with large leaves and bears fruit the size of a small grapefruit. So if you were in the desert and you saw this tree at a distance, first of all, you just can't believe this tree is even out here. It defies all odds that it would be there. And you get close to it and you see this fruit right there and you think, man, fruity goodness right in there. And I need that right now out in the desert. But when you get that fruit off the tree and you break it open, you get a puff of air. That's all you get, a puff of air. And you're greeted with an empty container, just a few silk strands in it. It's not really much there. And it has this milky substance from the skin that's considered poisonous to humans. So despite how beautiful it looks, there's really nothing there but death. And that's the object of Jeremiah's teaching in his book. He starts out his teaching talking about two trees in Jeremiah 17. And we've already talked about one of those trees, the acacia tree. Now notice the other tree. Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 5. This is what God says. Cursed is the one who trusts in man. And the word for cursed is arar. Arar. And knowing how Jeremiah works, it seems that Jeremiah is doing this wordplay with the word for cursed, arar, and the tree, arar. So, as it goes on, cursed is the one, arar is the one, who trusts in man, who draws strength from mere flesh, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. He will be like an arar in the desert. He will not see prosperity when it comes. He will dwell in the parched places of the desert in a salt land where no one lives. Interestingly, this cursed tree looks very healthy and abundant, doesn't it? Beautiful tree. And it's survived even hard times, and it still has done well in life. Like this tree, many people who rely on their own strength really persevere enough so that they seem to have it all. But we're not going to be judged by our tallness. We're not judged by our leafiness, right? Or our fame or notoriety, our material success. But on the fruit of our lives. So Jesus tells us that rocks and weeds in our lives can prevent us from bearing fruit. But it seems that even if we seem to be bearing fruit, like this arar tree, there's a danger that it might be quite empty. And that's the problem with the arar tree. The fruit has no juice. It's got nothing in there. You see, the tree is supposed to absorb the life-giving water from the soil and pass it on to others through its fruit, but something is not happening. This tree is taking the water and it's keeping it for himself and it's not producing anything. It's relying on its own strength. And this is the kind of tree that we do not want to be. There are some lessons here for us in the wilderness from these trees, these four trees that we looked at. But there's more to the story than just these trees. The story continues on. When you consider the Bible, we can't forget the first trees that come into mind. And we know that those are the trees of the Garden of Eden. The tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. One of those trees brings about life and the other one clearly brings about death. And it's interesting that Jeremiah talks about two trees. The tree that brings life and a tree that brings death, actually. I think they're probably talking about something similar. In a sense, the acacia tree is like the tree of life. The arar tree is like the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What did I say? We're called to be acacia trees. We're called to provide something for people. For somebody in their time of need. Which means we're called to be like the tree of life. That's really what this is about, isn't it? Deuteronomy 20 says that the trees that bear fruit are meant to provide us life. This is what he said to Israel. When you shall besiege a city a long time, in making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them. For you may eat of them, and you shall not cut them down. Why? For the tree of the field is man's life. That's what the trees are there for. They're for life. Trees bring life. And I want to show you, brethren, that you are all called to be trees. Trees that provide shade. Trees that bear fruit. Trees that heal. Trees that serve. So we are called to be trees in this life. Proverbs 11:30 says, "The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life." The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. But in the world to come, we are called to be a tree as well. Not just here, but in the world to come. We are called to be the tree of life in the world to come. We are to be part of that. The tree of life brings life. That's what you and I are here for, learning the lessons so we can become that. What did Jesus say? He said, "I am the vine. You are the branches." When you think of the tree of life, I would say Jesus is the trunk and we are the branches. We are to become a part of it. You are the tree that's planted by the riverside, that yields its fruit in its season, to provide for others, that sinks its roots deep down into the Spirit and draws from it to offer shade for others. Look at Revelation chapter 22 here. "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, water as clear as crystal, pouring out from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And flowing down the middle of the street on either side of the river was the tree of life, producing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month of the year. Its leaves are for the healing of the nations." Do you know something strange about this particular tree? It grows on both sides of the river. You ever see that before? You probably have. Do you ever thought much about it? It grows on both sides of the river. Do you know of any trees that grow on both sides of the river? Anything? Both. It's very, very strange. I want to look at Ezekiel chapter 47, because the imagery that we're going to see in Ezekiel chapter 47 is the same that we see in Revelation chapter 22 here. Of course, it's a picture given by God to each one of these men. No doubt John knew about Ezekiel chapter 47. But I want you to see something here you might not have noticed here in Ezekiel chapter 47. The prophet Ezekiel has been describing the temple for several chapters leading up to this particular chapter. And we come to chapter 47, and we see John's description actually very similar to this one. "Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river, and their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they will bear fruit, because the water from the sanctuary flows to them, and their fruit will serve for food and leaves for healing." Now I want you to notice here that just like Revelation, that we have trees that are growing on both sides, right, of the river. But there's something a little bit different, too. This says trees. Plural. I don't think we have any question that this is what John and Ezekiel are seeing, the same thing. John says one tree, though. John says one tree. Why is that? I came across something recently that I think answers the question. And where you find this is actually in the high plateaus of the Colorado Plateau in Utah. There is an aspen grove covering 106 acres. It grows here. It's called Pando. It's considered the heaviest single organism on the earth. The heaviest single organism on the earth. You see, brethren, this looks like thousands of individual trees. But do you know something about these? They are genetically identical. They all share a single root system. They are all together. Do you see trees on both sides of the river? You see that? Do you know a tree on both sides of the river? I only know of this one and the one in Revelation and Ezekiel. That's it. How can you have many trees in Ezekiel and one in Revelation? I think it depends on how you look at it. How can you have one God and yet so many God members? I think it depends on how you look at it. You see, the acacia tree was drawing from the streams that had leaves for healing. The trees in Ezekiel has leaves for healing, and the tree of life in Revelation has leaves for healing of the nations. You see, what I'm showing you, brethren, is that God is bringing you through the desert so that in the future you can be there to help heal others. God is the ultimate healer, but He always works through others to serve Him in that process. And you are the first fruits in that effort. Revelation chapter 22. There shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and His servants shall serve Him. Now, some versions actually take serve out of there and put worship in there. But they should leave serve in there. That's the word that should be there. When you think about this, this isn't the beatific vision. We make into the kingdom, and we don't sit there forever and just stare upon Jesus and the Father. No, we're active. We're doing something. He wants us to do something, and we are to serve Him. And how do you serve Him? You serve Him by serving others. That's how you serve Him. We serve others. You see, in this age, God has called you, brethren, to be a broom tree. He's called you to be an acacia tree. He's called you to be a tamarisk tree. He's called you this for now. But He also invites us to become a part of the tree of life in the future, in His kingdom, as healing for the nations, and we know that they're going to need to be healed. He's called us to be part of that remarkable and wonderful process. Are you ready for it? Are you ready for it to come? You have to learn the lessons of today. I have one scripture and a couple of thoughts before I end today. I'm going to show you something. Revelation chapter 7:16 says, "They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat." This particular painting is very special to me. Mr. David Teague painted this. He was here last feast in Jamaica. And this now is in the home office. He's painted several paintings for the home office. You can see this beautiful portrait that he's made of people obviously coming up to New Jerusalem in the millennium, right? And they're coming to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. You can see the Mount of Olives have been split and the river runs through it. And all the people are going up. Here's why it's so special to me. You see that little girl there? Right there. That's my daughter. And she's walking up to the feast. It's very exciting. No more heat. Deserts will be gone. There'll be no more thirst. An unlimited source of the Spirit. No more heat. All those trials that you experience will be gone. And you know what? There's going to be trees for food. And that's you. You're going to be trees for food for the nations that need healing. Because you're all plugged into the source of life and serving others. And all our deserts will be ended. Jesus is coming, and you're all going to be a part of it. Many years ago, as I close here, I heard a sermon probably about 32, 33 years ago. Dr. Clint Zimmerman would get up, and at the end of every feast, he would give a toast. And ever since then, we've always toasted, usually on the opening night of the service. Last couple of years, we've toasted here. And so, I want to toast with you to the kingdom. to what we have in store in the future, to the excitement that we will bring, and God is using us to heal other nations. So I'd like you, if you would, to take your cup, and I'd like you to stand. And I want you to toast to the kingdom with me. To the kingdom.
To the kingdom.
To the kingdom.
To the kingdom.
Amen.